Wow, it's gorgeous. This bridge is really beautiful. It's made of plaster, lime, and bricks, as I had studied in its history. As I have studied in the history books, this bridge used to separate the city into two parts. The administrative buildings were located on the western part of the bridge, and the residential and civil part of the city were on the eastern part of the bridge. Brilliant! Anyway, what is seen today is a wonderful history, a wonderful architecture, and a wonderful monument. Well, I have provided a list of historical bridges of the city of Ardabil, which I plan to visit. It's a great feeling to be in Iran, my beautiful Iran.
Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Economic divide.
You hear a lot about climate change and how the world is transforming more and more into green energy, at least trying to. But what about outsourcing emissions? Now, this has been around for a while, and many developed nations like the U.S. and European countries are guilty of it. Why are they doing this? That's what we're going to tell you in this edition of Economic Divide. Coming up in this program, we're going to take a look at what outsourcing emissions is. But Western nations, they're the ones that are standing accused. Parts of the industrial process is the problem here that's being outsourced. And China is being blamed for a carbon footprint. Why is that? We're going to take a close look at that. Over-reliance on China is one of the problems here. China is being blamed and attacked because of its carbon emissions being too excessive. Why is that? Well, more sustainable power sources needs to obviously happen, and alternate factory output instead of China also needs to be in the works. Is that happening? And finally, sanctioned countries. For example, Iran is accused of carbon emissions, but it's under sanctions. You have Western and U.S. sanctions preventing proper material access.
For years, climate activists have called for urgent action to tackle rising temperatures that have triggered devastating catastrophes all over the world. Western nations led by the U.S. and Germany have claimed success in reducing their emissions, and non-Western nations like China and India have been blamed for the crisis. But a closer look sheds light on the role played by industrialized nations in world pollution. In simple terms, rich countries are just outsourcing their climate pollution to poorer countries by shifting their factories overseas. Wealthy OECD nations consume a fair bit more CO2 than they actually emit within their own borders. A little explanation is needed here. When a country's carbon emissions are calculated, only carbon emitted within that country is typically counted. These are known as territorial emissions, but in reality, it distorts the truth. Countries in the global north, the USA, UK, Japan, France, and Germany in particular, are increasingly outsourcing key parts of their industrialized processes. Emissions involved in the production of consumer goods like items of clothing or kitchen gadgets are counted as China and India's responsibility. Steel production, for example, specifically accounts for around 10% of China's CO2 emissions. Calls are now growing among activists for action on consumption-based emissions.
Also, I think the important thing is that once you have a mechanism on the pricing of the carbon, then the whole society will be mobilized because they know we already had a price on carbon, and they know that price of carbon will only go up because the overall direction of the carbon emission is to go down, right? Then you have the scarcity of the as a commodity so that people can start to time in and integrate it into their decision-making process and making long-term plans.
It's time now for the social media posts. Obviously, when it comes to a topic like climate change, or in our case, outsourcing emissions, lots of entries there because there's so many climate change conferences that have taken place. And one of the things that maybe not covered as much as it should is outsourcing emissions. First, we take a look at this website entry, The Cost of Trade. Rich countries have outsourcing carbon dioxide emissions, where it said when a country reports its carbon emissions to the UN, it is the carbon dioxide that goes out of chimneys, exhaust pipes, and forest fires of the country's own territory that gets counted. Adding, but what about the carbon emitted elsewhere by people making goods that the country imports? Next up, outsourcing emission is a result of us taking up emission targets and sticking to them while China does not care about it. So there you have an opposing view, blaming China. Maybe this person needs to get educated a little bit more on this topic. Next, the modern relation of those two nations. Outsourcing is, after all, one of the reasons why China is such an emission producer, and it started in the U.S. outsourcing its labor to Asia. So the U.S. has quite a big blame in this also, almost a respond to the previous post. Then, so you are saying don't massively cut down emissions in the U.S. because somebody else isn't? This is a child's reasoning for why they should not do something. Also, per capita, China has half the emissions that the U.S. has. So it seems that the U.S. has more to do to reduce their emissions than China. And then finally, according to Japanese component producer Kyocera, Washington's chip regulations are effectively stripping China off its shine as a world factory. All right, we can see that the U.S. China dominated the topic of outsourcing emissions. No surprise, they're the number one, two economies in the world. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of the program. Joining us is David Carione, who's an oceanographer, and he's also a social and environmental activist. David Carione, welcome to Economic Divide. Outsourcing emissions. So Western nations, they've been accused of this. We're looking at countries in the global north, US, UK, Japan, Germany, for example, and France, increasingly outsourcing key parts of their industrial process. They're blaming China, however, for this carbon footprint and CO2 emissions. Is it because they don't want, the natural question, they don't want their company, their country, to be impacted by climate change and these CO2 emissions?
Well, maybe first, thank you for the invitation to talk about this important issue. Even though I'm from the working class, I represent a position of privilege here in my country, being male and white. That said, I wonder why why the governments of the countries of the global north, they have so much difficulty to recognize the privilege they have to think about climate emergency and carbon emissions. Is it perhaps because this privilege was constituted from an uninterrupted process of colonial and imperialist exploitation? And why? Because the solution involves them having to give up their privilege. When we look for the estimates of territorial dioxide carbon emissions for the last 200 years, it can be seen that the United States lead by a large margin in relation to China, for example, which is the second in position. It's almost the double. So keeping this in mind, I would like to bring another issue related with the social inequalities. It's about to whom the governments of the global north works for. It's for the benefits for all the people that inhabit its borders or for a small elite, for example.
All right, we appreciate that. Thank you. Let's find out what Wilmer Leon thinks. He is our next guest. He is a columnist and political scientist who joins us. Wilmer Leon, welcome to Economic Divide. So outsourcing emissions, looking at developed nations, in particular the U.S. and Europe, are responsible for outsourcing this, as we have said, to other parts of the world. In particular, we're looking at Asia, like China. Of course, there are other countries involved. When you take a look at the whole climate change issue that's happening, this outsourcing is one of the major things that is the focus of climate change. And whether that's right or wrong for these countries to do that, China has accepted it. Are we looking at that being the focus here that needs to be addressed?
Yes, it does. And I think what countries are finding is, as China has focused on pulling people out of poverty, as China has focused on developing a stronger middle class. I mean, I think the numbers have been, they've pulled around 800 million people out of abject poverty. So the cost of manufacturing in China has increased. Countries are looking to other places like Vietnam, for example, to offset some of the manufacturing that China used to do. And in terms of coal has been one of the traditional power sources for an incredibly long time. And now what you find is China is one of the world's leading manufacturers of solar panels. And so China has been finding alternative sources, renewable sources of energy, and trying to, I think, to move away from coal.
It's time now for the InfoNews section of the program, where we pick four topics to cover from different parts of the world. First up, let's take a look at a cost factor here, where it's focused on King Charles' coronation from the UK. Now, it says 3.9 million children and 9.6 million adults live in a poverty in the UK, on the one hand, and then you have this coronation, where it says the Charles' coronation is expected to cost around £100,000, where it breaks it down and says £33,333 per day is what that translates into over 3 days for one man, an unelected head of state, to have a crown put on his head. It does put things into perspective there, doesn't it? So there you talk about excessive spending when it comes to the whole king and monarchy in the UK. All right. Next up, this is a very dark milestone. The Ukraine one-year anniversary has just passed. Okay. The special military conflict by Russia continues. Meanwhile, the United States, in this particular piece of news that we picked, has sent almost $30 billion to Ukraine. Some figures say up to $50 billion. That is only significant because of the fact that, according to one particular source, it would cost $20 billion to end homelessness in the U.S. Okay? $20 billion. And the U.S. has sent $30 billion in 1 year to that country, maybe up to $50 billion. So this money, if it were to be spent in the U.S. to eradicate homelessness, it would also end hunger and poverty at the same time. Two pieces of news that we covered there, which shows the excessive spending, one in a war and one for a coronation. All right. Next up, let's take a look at the topic of food rationing that we picked for you. The rationing of fruits and veggies in the UK is where this is happening, believe it or not. The politics and economics behind it is what's causing it. The supermarkets in the UK are running short of things like lettuce, tomatoes, peppers, cucumbers, broccoli, and cauliflowers, not to mention raspberries, and they're rationing a certain amount only that can be bought by consumers in that country. That's pretty incredible, if you ask me. Next up, and finally, the U.S. housing market is what we picked. What we are seeing, and this is not just restricted to this piece of news, is almost widespread, is that the house price crash that would wreck finances in the U.S. is happening. And Britain is also suffering from it based on this particular piece of news, where it says that there are signs of a severe downturn in the U.S. property market. Home sales at this point are down for 12 straight months in a row in that country. And of course, that's in tandem with inflation refusing to come under control. All right, those were the topics we picked for this section, the InfoNews section.
You're listening to Economic Divide. This series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
The program is upon us. Where CO2 emissions occur and where related products are consumed, they are two different things. Don't forget that. With that intro, let's get into our in-depth section. First, what are developed countries vis-a-vis developing countries, in case you don't know that? For the ones who don't know, developed country is a sovereign state that has a developed economy and advanced technological infrastructure relative to other less industrialized nations, okay? It's important for, obviously, you to know the difference there between developed and developing countries. Next, products imported by consumers in developed countries, like in Western Europe, in Japan, or the U.S., relate to substantial CO2 emissions in other countries, like in China, which means over a third, in this case, of consumption-related carbon dioxide in developed countries may actually be emitted elsewhere, which is the point we made in the intro. All right, let's look at a comparison now on CO2 emissions between the two largest economies in the world, namely the United States and China. China, for example, generates around 30% of all global emissions. All right, then you have the United States. That's responsible for almost 14%. It's quite a disparity, isn't there? I'm sure you agree. Why is that a disparity? That's the whole topic on this program, outsourcing emissions from the U.S., in this case, to China. Next, on to Europe, where the numbers are actually even higher, specifically between a third and a half of the emissions related to the goods and services that are consumed in many European countries. Well, they actually also occur elsewhere. Okay? All right, let's see what our guest thinks. Devi Kariani, he's an oceanographer and social and environmental activist, rejoins us here on Economic Divide. Devi Kariani, welcome back to Economic Divide. So, taking a look at Iran, it has been accused of carbon and CO2 emissions. Now, we're looking at where the blame, why the blame is falling on Iran, because we're looking at a country, the Islamic Republic, to be under sanctions. That prevents factories from in Iran to have access to some of the raw materials that are needed that prevent CO2 emissions. So isn't the fault blamed inaccurately and not in terms of it not being the right blame to be placed on Iran?
Well, this question makes me think about the idea of sovereignty and how the nations of the Global South experience a condition of economic, technological, and cultural dependence on the countries of the North. Dependence, and of course, dependence caused by imposition, power imposition. So, in my opinion, each country should be encouraged to find its best strategies to overcome this challenge of geography of carbon emissions and the climate emergency. And for that, they should take into account their technology capabilities, the natural resources they have available, and of course, the historical process. And they should also never be pressured to jeopardize the needs to continuously improve the quality of life of their population and reduction of poverty and social inequalities within their borders.
All right. Well, in terms of the issue at hand, however, it had to deal with why Iran did not have access to proper material in order to prevent the type of carbon emissions that it's being blamed for. But nevertheless, let's move on to our guest, Wilmer Leon, a columnist and political scientist who rejoins us. Wilmer Leon, welcome back to Economic Divide. Let's take a look at China's carbon footprint. Obviously, it's substantial. I'm sure you know that. We're looking at coal industry in China, for example, which is a representative of three-quarters of its emissions. And it's clear, with the rest of the world, obviously it needs to move towards a more sustainable way of accessing resources. But when you take a look at the reliance on China, which has been labeled to being the factory of the world, isn't that something that needs to be addressed?
Well, I think concern about global warming and concern about carbon emissions is one element. But I think that there's been one of the larger concerns or realities is that the United States and other Western countries have moved away from being in having industrial-based economies and have moved more to financialized economies. And so the United States has outsourced a lot of its industry to China, to Vietnam, to India, to Sri Lanka, depending on what it is that needs to be manufactured. As we have globalized economies, we have and these multinational corporations are traversing the world looking for the cheapest labor possible, because we know in manufacturing labor is one of the highest costs in terms of production.
Outsourcing of emissions comes in the form of electronic devices like smartphones, cheap clothes, and other goods manufactured in China and other rising economies but consumed in the US and Europe. According to reports, since the year 2000, annual carbon dioxide emissions for China and the other rising economies have more than doubled to nearly 40 gigatons a year. But about 2 gigatons a year of that was produced making goods for export. Other middle-income countries with smaller exports saw a more gradual rise in emissions. Factories in China and other rising economies now produce more carbon pollution than industries in America and Europe. The outsourcing of those emissions has skewed efforts to account for all global emissions.
事实上呢，中方在这些问题上一直是负责任地发挥着建设性的作用。当然，需要强调的是，合作需要以互信为基础，以互利为前提。 以良好的双边关系氛围作为必要的条件，美方应当树立正确的合作观，不能一边寻求合作，一边损害中国的利益，这个是行不通的。Iran
is also another country accused of carbon and CO2 emissions. Iran has also been impacted by climate change like every other place in the world.
Emissions have also soared in recent years, as overseas investments in renewable energy have collapsed. But the country cannot be entirely blamed for rising emissions, since it has been under Western-led sanctions for years. The measures have prevented Iran and its factories from having access to new technologies, material, and equipment that can decrease its carbon footprint.
This segment takes a look at what China has done to try to limit its carbon footprint, given that it's the leading carbon emitter in the world. In 2021, China launched its long-awaited emissions trading system, a key tool in its quest to drive down climate changing, causing greenhouse gases. This scheme will set pollution caps for big power businesses for the first time and allows firms to buy the right to pollute from others with a lower carbon footprint. China ultimately wants to go carbon neutral by 2060. The market will initially cover 2,100 big power producers that generate about a seventh of the global carbon emissions from burning fossil fuels. Those power producers account for 40% of the around 14 billion tons of earth-warming gases belched out by Chinese factories in 2019. Meanwhile, the EU announced in December 2022 that a deal was struck to overhaul the bloc's carbon market. This would cut the planet heating emissions faster and imposing new CO2 costs on fuels used in road transport and buildings from 2027. The EU carbon market requires around 10,000 power plants and factories to buy CO2 permits when they pollute, a system central to meeting the EU's target to cut its net emissions 55% by 2030 compared with 1990 levels. Under the deal agreed by negotiators from EU countries and the European Parliament, the EU carbon market will be reformed to cut emissions by 62% from 2005 levels by 2030. And finally, what about the U.S.? President Joe Biden vowed at UN climate talks in Egypt that the United States was on track to slash its carbon emissions. Biden touted that passage of a massive $369 billion spending package to green the United States economy. Then why is the U.S. luring European factories to move to the U.S.? Washington has also come under criticism for falling short on its pledges to financially help developing countries with their own transitions and to cope with intensifying climate-induced impacts.
We're proving that good climate policy is good economic policy. It's a strong foundation for durable, resilient, inclusive economic growth.
It was a well-received speech, but the U.S. continues, unfortunately, to fall short of what it needs to do on the global stage, and that remains a reality here.
That does it for this Quick Take segment. If you have any questions or comments, we appreciate greatly if you get in touch with us. I'm Mahdi Abbasian, and I'll see you next week.
So, in conclusion, developed nations, in order to not experience the impacts of climate change, they are outsourcing their emissions to other countries, like to China, to make their products, which are shipped back to their country. Then they blame those countries for high emissions, again, China and even Iran. But in the bigger picture, there is only one planet Earth, and outsourcing emissions will still impact Earth. There needs to be a better solution because consumerism is not going anywhere, at least for now. At least it seems that way. That does it for this edition of the program. Thank you so much for tuning in. From Mikhail Tavley and the entire team at Economic Divide, it's goodbye until the next program.
option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
History of Knowledge in Iran. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are with you with the fourth episode of the series in which we make you familiar with a few Iranian scientists to whom mankind is indebted in various fields of sciences. If you remember, we talked briefly on Abu Musa Khwarazmi, the great mathematician who was also outstanding in astronomy and has rendered great services to both fields. Today, we will continue discussing math and getting familiar with another Iranian genius in the field, namely Abu Reyhan Biruni. Stay tuned, please. Math is considered an applicable science in the broad region of the Islamic Iranian civilization. In view of this, many discoveries have taken place in this land in various branches of math. All these occurred while the dark era of ignorance and enmity with knowledge was dominant in most parts of the world. Turkish historian and author Halil İnalcık explains the conditions in those days. What shaped the Islamic civilization was production of knowledge based on Islamic thought, theosophy and philosophy, which took place through the Islamic Iranian culture in the 4th century AH. In that era, Europe was in ignorance. A synthesis of the Iranian and Islamic cultures was formed during the first era of the Islamic civilization. Iranian researcher Dr. Musa Najafi also says, the 4th and 5th centuries were the era of climax of the Islamic civilization. In the next eras too, the Islamic civilization was in its zenith. For example, the 9th century AH was the period of the rule of Safavids in Iran. But the Islamic civilization, in its climax, delivered great figures to the human civilization such as Ibn Sina, Abu Reyhan Biruni, Farabi, Khaja Nizam al-Mulk Tusi, and many other thinkers. In the first period of thriving the Islamic civilization, there were many narrators and scholars of hadith and thinkers, mainly helped this civilization flourish in philosophy and the common sciences of their age. Yet, in the next periods, indexes changed and most of them tilted towards mystics, art, and architecture. Turkish researcher of Islamic sciences Dr. Fuat Sezgin says, I'd like to show you a device whose name has not been registered in the history of math. It is Abu Reyhan Biruni, who introduces this device to us. This device is used for drawing circle on the pattern of planet Earth. If you don't have such a device, you won't be able to draw an accurate circle on planet Earth. This is among the devices which were mentioned in Abu Reyhan Biruni's book. The name of the device can be translated as interconnected two-sided ruler. You put the circle or page
between the two rulers and draw your desired line or shape on both sides. This device had remained unknown in the history of math till 19th century. Who is Abu Rayhan Biruni? Abu Rayhan Mohammad ibn Ahmad Biruni was the prominent Iranian scientist of the second half of the 4th century and early 5th century AH. He has elaborately written innumerable books in math, astronomy, pharmaceuticals, and geography. Biruni is among the geniuses whose scientific figure was revealed to the world through the progress of sciences. He was a master of most natural sciences of his time and was among the first persons who embarked on finding a special weight of many objects. His findings were so precise that his calculations have very little difference with what recent scholars have found with modern equipment. Abu Rayhan would travel to different regions and measure the longitude and latitude of those regions and would determine the location of every city on a globe. Years later, he successfully drew those regions on a flat map. This was, in fact, the prelude to cartography as a subcategory of geography. Biruni managed to calculate the most accurate length of the Earth in his time and raised the likelihood of the Earth's rotation around itself. This Iranian genius spent long periods of his life in India. He studied the history, beliefs, customs, and philosophy of Indians. The Indian scholars would not welcome him at first, but very soon he drew their trust and was invited to various circles and gatherings to show a part of the Iranian culture and civilization on one hand and study their customs and past record more deeply. These studies resulted in writing the book Tahqiq Mal al-Hind, or Research on India. After over 1,000 years, this book has been the best reference for research on India. Abu Rayhan Biruni, in an essay, studies the precedence of finding the important theorem of sines and tangents by Iranian scientists and examines the share of each of them. Biruni's studies are very useful for the students who want to be top scholars in geometry. His explanations on various geometrical and mathematical concepts are different from those of Euclid. He tries to give more tangible definitions of concepts. Biruni has explained the rule for ascending of foundations and springs in a scientific language. Then he speaks about the running of water from the depth of wells and springs. A brief look at Biruni's works indicates that he was one of the most prolific writers of the Islamic era. If we judge him according to his works, we should say that he has spent a lot of time on each of these works and written them with profound research. That's why he describes his love of his works to the love of people toward their children. Abu Rayhan Biruni has presented a list of his works, according to which he has completed 103 works, left 10 works unfinished, and authored 25 works in collaboration with other writers. The Iranian genius used to call himself as a servant of knowledge. He would say, "I thank God for being able to be at the service of knowledge since childhood." A scholar by the name of Abu al-Hasan Ali ibn Isa writes, "When Abu Rayhan was at his deathbed, I went to visit him. He asked me a jurisprudential issue. I told him that it was not a proper time to ask such a question. He said, Which one is better, to know this and die or die without knowing it? I told him the answer and left him. A few steps away, I heard the sound of mourning and crying from Abu Reyhan's house. This event has been narrated in historical books on the last moments of Biruni's life. He passed away in 440 AH, 1049 AD, in the city of Ghaznain.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on October 3rd, 2022, during the joint graduation ceremony for the cadets studying in the academies of the Islamic Republic of Iran's armed forces. The ceremony was held in Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba alayhi salam University of Office and Police Training. These riots had been planned. If the incident with the young girl had not taken place, they have found another excuse to create insecurity and riots in the country in the beginning of the month of May, September this year. Well, how can you not see foreign hands at play? How can an attentive person not sense that there are other hands behind the scenes of these events? Other policies are at play. Of course, they falsely pretend that they care that someone has passed away in the world. They are lying. They are not upset by this. They are not upset by this at all. In fact, they are happy. They are happy because they have a pretext for creating unrest. They lie.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Here, the heads of the three powers of the state, executive, legislative, judicial, expressed their sorrow and sympathized with the grieving family. Then certain elements murder other people who are innocent and have not committed any crime. The judiciary promised to follow up on this to the end. This is what investigations are all about. It means following up on a case, seeing the results, and seeing if anyone was guilty of something or not, and if someone was guilty, identify them. How can you make false accusations and insult such a huge organization that serves the people over the probability that perhaps one or two people have made a mistake before any research or proof has been presented? There is no logic behind this. It is clearly the work of none other than the spy agencies and malicious foreign politicians. Now, what is the motive of these foreign governments? My perception is that they feel that the country is progressing toward achieving a comprehensive power, and they cannot tolerate this. They can feel this and see it. They can see that many old problems are fortunately being solved. Although the country has many problems, some of which started years ago, but serious work is being done to solve these problems and untie these knots.
things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight.
While Israelis protest against Netanyahu and Ben-Gvir's war on the judiciary, the High Court of the Zionist regime enables the occupying regime's use of torture against Palestinian prisoners. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye noted, before the current far-right government's war on the judiciary, there was a little covered news story out of the Zionist regime's Supreme Court. On December 29, 2022, the Zionist regime's High Court once again capitulated to the demands of the regime regarding the issue of prison conditions and the size of prison cells in particular. It granted the regime's request and extended, for the third time, the deadline for expanding the living space of detainees until December 31, 2027. In response to a petition by Israeli human rights organizations, including the Association for Civil Rights, ACRI, the Supreme Court issued an order in June 2017 to expand the living space of prisoners to 4.5 square meters, giving the Zionist regime's prison service an initial deadline of 9 months. In most Western countries, the size of standard prison cells ranges between 6 and 12 square meters, while in the occupied territories, it is less than 3 square meters. The ruling seemed to acknowledge the cruel, humiliating, and inhuman living conditions of the prisoners. In the opening statement of the decision, Judge Yitzhak Amit wrote that society is evaluated through its treatment of prisoners. He pointed out that depriving them of their freedom through imprisonment does not mean depriving them of their right to dignity, which stems from the prisoner's right to determine the minimum living space. However, despite this statement, the court approved maintaining these conditions for an additional 5 years, which then became 10 years from the initial judgment. In 2014, ACRI, Physicians for Human Rights, PHRI, and other groups petitioned the Zionist regime Supreme Court to address overcrowding in Israeli jails and prisons and compel the regime to immediately increase the living area of prisoners to a minimum 4.5 square meters as a temporary solution until it is raised even further as part of a long-term plan. The petition stated that prisoners are forced to spend hours of their day in bed without the ability to move or stand, and those sharing a cell are unable to stand or walk at the same time in the limited space. As a result, prisoners are often forced to carry out their entire daily routine in bed, including eating. It further argues that overcrowding creates suffocation in the cells, harms the health of the prisoners, and causes increased friction between them. It is far from the acceptable size in countries considered democratic and from the minimum adopted by international institutions to ensure reasonable, adequate living conditions that are mentioned in the 2012 report published by the International Committee of the Red Cross. Unfortunately, the situation in the Zionist regime's prisons has been the same for decades, but the regime has done nothing to offer solutions or make changes. In its 2019 to 2020 annual report, the Zionist regime's public defense warned of prison overcrowding and prisoner rights violations. The report described the existing prison conditions as a serious violation of human dignity. It criticized the narrow size of the prison cell at 2.5 square meters, asserting that it is too small for even one resident. The report reiterated earlier calls to immediately stop holding prisoners in these cells, maintaining that they are unfit for human beings. It further noted that the prison cell area today is less than half of the minimum approved by the Zionist regime's prison service, the main carceral authority, which specified 6 square meters as a reasonable amount of space. The public defense report further held that this matter not only affects the rights of detainees, but also violates the regime's obligation to refrain from cruel, inhumane, and degrading punishment, a basic standard of international law. On June 13, 2017, the Zionist regime Supreme Court ordered the regime to increase the minimum prison living area. To ease the implementation of these reforms, the High Court divided the process into two stages. The first would grant the regime 9 months to increase the living area for prisoners to 3 square meters, not including a toilet and shower. An additional 9 months from the court order to increase the living area further to 4.5 square meters would comprise the second stage. However, on March 5, 2018, a week before the deadline for Stage 1 reforms expired, the regime submitted a request to the court to postpone the implementation for 10 years from the initial ruling to 2027. The regime argued that the compliance with the timeline established by the court would require a mass release of prisoners and endanger the public. The petitioners rejected these claims, arguing that the regime took no action to conduct new detention centers and restating the High Court's observation about the inadequate facilities, many of which were built during the British Mandate. It also opposed the suggestion of a public safety issue, calling these idle threats intended to intimidate the court. The court sharply criticized the regime's actions and initially rejected the regime's request. This compelled the regime to submit a plan to construct new wings for hundreds of security prisoners and an increase of administrative release that will result in the evacuation of about 1,000 places of confinement. In June 2018, the Zionist regime updated the court on its intent to use Saharonim prison in Negev Desert as an immigration detention center as part of the first stage of reform. As for the second stage of the ruling, guaranteeing a minimum living space of 4.5 square meters for each prisoner, by December 2018, the regime failed to make any progress on this matter, leading human rights groups to demand that the court force it to adhere to the letter of its judgment. In a notice issued on July 29, 2018, the Zionist regime informed the court of its plan to establish by the year 2026 new centers for housing prisoners interrogated by Shin Bet, the Zionist regime security service. It also announced its intent to petition the High Court to amend its judgment in order to exempt Shin Bet facilities from expanding the living space for prisoners until 2027. Currently, Shin Bet cell size is 2 square meters or less. The petitioners representing various human rights groups opposed the regime's request, arguing that this population should actually receive priority in the efforts to adapt prison conditions to the court's ruling, and that postponing the execution date of the ruling by at least 8 years is unreasonable.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
A ribbon-cutting ceremony to go down in history, opening the production line of Iran's first homegrown jet trainer, Yasin. According to Iran's Defense Minister, Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani, the jet trainer is capable of carrying out combat missions as well as other tactical aerial warfare actions such as close air support or CAS, air-to-ground actions against hostile targets in close proximity of friendly forces.
Training good pilots is extremely important, and now with this homegrown jet trainer, we have technologically evolved significantly. This is considered a major step for our Air Force. The training period will now be shorter and more comprehensive.
Prior to this, jet pilot training was done outside Iran, and due to Western and U.S. sanctions, Iranian pilots could not receive training abroad.
We did ask for assistance, but no country in the world helped us. However, at the end of the day, it worked out for the best because we were able to develop the technology that we needed ourselves. Knowledge-based companies help us a lot. In particular, I have to point out the design of the engine and also its aerodynamic design. All in all, Yasin is about 800 kilometers lighter than our first prototype, which is a significant achievement.
Iran started designing jet trainers over 10 years ago. Yasin is the second generation of a prototype that was unveiled in 2019. The new version now includes state-of-the-art avionics, engine, landing gear, and full cockpit devices.
With all the equipment installed, this training jet is fully equipped and it can be used for training pilots in all different levels.
But there's more to Yasin than just training fighter jet pilots.
It is also a question of prestige. This jet trainer was made by our own scientists and inventors. Knowledge-based companies played a very important part. Obviously, it means great economic benefits, but other than that, it shows that we can stand on our own feet. This is the most important message.
In the next 2 years, three more Yassin jet trainers will be produced based on the requirements of Iran's Air Force.
Iran has made great achievements in the field of aviation, and this is a symbol of self-sufficiency of the Islamic Republic. Gisumi Shah Ahmadi, Tehran.
Despite the cold winter day, a huge turnout by thousands of NHS workers and their supporters calling for action in a dispute officially about inflation matching pay, but really so much more than just that.
It's about